Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Four Arrows, Wahinkpe Topa, whose Anglo name is Donald Trent Jacobs. He's a professor at Fielding Graduate University and formerly the Dean of Education at Oglala Lakota College on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, South Dakota. He was selected by the Alternative Education Resource Organization as one of 27 visionaries in education. He won Martin Springer Institute Moral Courage Award for his activism. He's been involved in creating the first marine no-take zone on Pacific Coast of Mexico. He's an American Indian activist and author of 21 books and numerous articles and chapters about indigenous worldview applications to contemporary world issues. His most recent book is Point of Departure, Returning to a More Authentic Worldview for Education and Survival. Now, we talked about this a few weeks ago, sort of talked about the book in general, and then today the plan is for us to reintroduce the book and then to talk about some specifics that we didn't get to because we were having so much fun talking about the larger picture last time. So, first, thank you for your work as always, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Well, it's my pleasure, and we did have fun. I enjoy our conversations because they take us on a journey where we stop every once in a while and look over the side at this beautiful view that we both kind of gasp at. I like that. So maybe we'll come on that, and maybe some of the listeners will also.
Yeah, I hope so. So first, to bring people up to where we were, can you do like a 5-minute introduction to this new book, Point of Departure?
Well, sure. The book is essentially taking off on a theory that the first social anthropologist, Robert Redfield from the University of Chicago in the 50s, sort of started in terms of understanding what we call worldviews. And he believed there was only two of them, unlike a lot of scholars who say there's millions. He said all of our cultures and beliefs and religions really fall under the umbrella of essentially two worldviews. He said there were three, the Oriental, but now there's the indigenous and the dominant one, because so much of the Oriental has fallen under the Western and the dominant one. And so what I'm saying in here is that for 99% of human history, we operated according to a worldview with many, many cultures under each one that are very different, but that have common denominators that we've lost in our dominant worldview. And as a result of that, have put us in a predicament in terms of a possible mass extinction. And so I believe that instead of looking just at technologies and engineering and behaviors under this worldview, my hypothesis is that if we could return in modern times to some essential worldview precepts, that we could start to regain our balance. And in this book, I identify really just five of them. One is what I call the naturalistic trance-based learning, sort of like self-hypnosis and sometimes spontaneous unintended hypnosis, for good or bad, that's influenced by how indigenous worldviews see four other ideas that relate to how we interpret fear, authority, words, and nature. And what we're going to try to do in our 45 minutes is sort of introduce each of these so that folks can really have a very practical way of rethinking some of the unconscious behaviors that we all do that have put us into such imbalance in our personal lives, in our communities, and with regard to our ecosystems.
So let's start by trance-based learning. Can you introduce it a bit more than you have there? And then I'm sure that both of us will have some anecdotes about that might or might not be interesting.
Sure.
I'm thinking about my own being possibly not interesting. anyway, go ahead.
Listen. Let's talk about the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years that our ancestors lived in a nature-based world view. They didn't have words like trance, I'm sure, and hypnosis, of course, had never been coined terminology. They did understand deeply, however, that in the animal world and in their own species world, that transformative learning often came from alternative modes of consciousness. And over time, they use those modes of consciousness for the kinds of learning that they knew would be important to maintain balance, especially keeping balance with holding at bay the kinds of things like greed or jealousy or power, lust, that are always, you know, creeping in the human psyche. And so they did a variety of ways to move into that consciousness so that their predetermined wisdom could be deeply seated and implemented in their daily behaviors. You know, we know they did chanting intentionally to move into those ways, vision quests, a variety of rites of passage, initiations, a whole number of sacred ceremonies for different occasions that included dancing and music, plant medicine, of course, on occasion, meditative states. All of these things were used, drumming, to bring themselves into the place where they could communicate with themselves, with spiritual energies around them, in order to be more virtuous, in order to live in balance, in order to be engaged in survival with success. And so we're at a time now where, you know, a lot of these opportunities have been lost to us, or are, you know, made fun of, or romanticized, or we just don't have the community-based skills or guidance for them. But in my book, what I'm saying is we are in and out of this natural state all the time, and we just aren't aware of it. Other people are really in control of it. Salesmen sometimes using these kinds of strategies that in Western science we have studied to understand hypnotic language. I learned mine from wild horses, which we can talk about maybe later, but because animals also engage in this phenomenon. That's why when you see a herd of wildebeest, you know, on television, all turning at the same moment, you know, by the thousands to run away from a lion, there was a phenomenon that happened that refers to what it is that I'm talking about when I say TBL, trance-based learning. And so this phenomenon we can become aware of, know that it exists, know that many of our uninvestigated preconceptions that keep us from doing other than what is needed and right in our survival and our relationships, they have been, especially in early childhood when our hypnotic skills are the highest, they have been sort of, to use the modern computer jargon, programmed. And we behave according to them when defense mechanisms are triggered to bring them into play. And we can change those. Epigenetic studies have showed that we can. We have to be aware of them so that we can change them, and we have to have simple tools so we don't have to go pay someone else, which relates to some of the other criteria of fear, authority, words, and nature, because they are inseparable from this trance-based phenomenon. And how we look at fear, authority, words, and nature determines whether let's call it, you know, the TBL or the hypnosis, how it actually influences us depends on whether we use the indigenous worldview as relates to fear, authority, words, and nature, or whether we're under the belief systems of those four things that are common in the dominant culture. And so this is sort of a mnemonic. I actually use a mnemonic called cat and fawn. Cat meaning concentration activated transformation, which is just another word for trance-based learning, and fawn being, of course, the four concepts and how they interplay with each other.
So before we move on, I want to stay on this topic for a second, and I want to tell a couple stories that Jeanette Armstrong, who's this wonderful Okanagan writer and activist, told me. And one of them was, she told me about a dance they do in their community where, as people are dancing, it's a dance about bundling reeds. And she said that as they dance, they make the motion of bundling reeds again and again, But the point of the dance is not really to simply mimic the motion of bundling reeds, but also is to enable them to bundle as a community. So I'm just mentioning that. And then the other thing is, she told me one time that she had been called in to basically do an intervention on someone who was getting out of a terribly abusive relationship. And she said that one of the things they were going to do was over the weekend, they were going to be there for like 10 days or something. And over that 10 days, they were going to use various symbols. She didn't say anything more than what I'm going to tell you now. They were going to use various symbols and various parts of what you would presumably then call trance-based learning in order to basically accomplish what would take 10 or 12 years in therapy, that they were going to do this to help access parts of her unconscious to help her break away from some of those patterns that she had gained in abusive relationships. So I guess I'm bringing up these two examples to ask, are these two examples of what you're talking about?
Absolutely. Greg Cahati, who's a good friend of mine, co-author and director of Indigenous Studies at the University of New Mexico, he always talks about how Indigenous thinking is metaphorical. And, use of metaphor is also happens to be a very powerful a technique or strategy in clinical hypnosis and other kinds of hypnosis. We got the Olympics going on right now, and I can guarantee you that there's probably not a single person that has won a medal who has not used a sports psychologist to help them visualize and use that during their competition. So, all of the metaphors that relate to the strength of bundling and how what that means for a community, how it relates to the power of the reeds themselves and what is made with them, and how that connects to the intentionality of the dance, are all these optimal ways of learning those ideas that continue to keep us at our optimal way of being in the world. And so, yes, it's a natural and powerful way to achieve something that we have let go. In fact, worse than let go, Derek, I wrote a book many years ago, I think 1998, called Patient Communication for First Responders, in which Norman Cousins, really, who had been at the UCLA psychoneuroimmunology, he had hired actors and actresses to act sick or to act well, and measured their white blood cell counts as they acted. Good acting, really believing in it, which is is what we're talking about, trance-based learning. And they were able to change white blood cell count significantly with this. So I had been a paramedic for 15 years and had found that, as a result of actually, my work with wild horses, which is kind of just an ancillary story, that I could go up to someone who was in a medical emergency and assume that they were in a natural state of hypersuggestibility or trance. And one time I was taking a course that the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons had written a book called Care and Transportation of the Sick and Injured. And I remember on page Roman numeral 8, they say, be careful what you say at the scene of an emergency, because words can become fixed in the patient's mind and cause untold harm. So I immediately thought, well, if they could cause untold harm, why not the opposite? And so Prentice Hall published my book, and in a very short while, it was banned. I was on a world speaking tour in Brisbane, Australia, and talking to 1,500 emergency room physicians who came to me and said, we can't order the book. Well, attorneys came to the situation, I was told, and said that this book should be used only by licensed medical physicians trained in hypnosis by the American Academy of Clinical Hypnosis, and they pulled the book off the market. And yet salesmen do it all the time, preachers, but most of the religions now have said that this is something of the devil. And so here we are with this most naturalistic tool that instead of us being in control of it, we have inadvertently give control to others.
There's a couple more stories I want to talk about this. And at this rate, we're going to get only through trance-based learning in this interview, but we'll worry about that in a second.
Well, then they'll buy the book.
Yeah. So one story is, I'm glad you brought that up about the Olympics, because that reminded me, when I was in college, I was a high jumper and I read a lot. And actually I called up college professors who were hypnotists too, because I wanted to learn more about, I didn't call it trance-based learning. I called it, I don't know what I called it, self-hypnosis or something. I wanted to learn more about becoming a better jumper. And one of the studies I read was that they did a study of two sets of skiers, and one set did practice runs, and the other set did one set of practice runs to get used to the course, and then after that, they did everything else imagining it instead of actually running the course. And what they found is that in many cases, the ones who did the runs internally instead of externally actually did better, that was at least as effective. They would get very relaxed and then they would run through it. And I put that into my own practice as a jumper. And then when I was later a coach, I did it with my jumpers too, that the day before, a couple days before any track meet, instead of actually jumping, what we would do is I would have them sit there and then we just imagine the entire track meet, and they get up and they stand there at their mark, and then they, in their head, go through the jump, and then they sit back down and they wait a while and then do the next jump. And this was very, very effective. I mean, so I guess I'm saying this in terms of trying to, you know, if we say trance-based learning, that sounds really dramatic, but this is just, like you've said several times now, and I'm finally getting, this is something that we all enter. You know, those of us who, I mean, how many of us have faced a problem, and so you go start walking through a forest, and the solutions come flowing to you from the trees and from the land everywhere else?
Well, you're right on. Let me jump in on a couple of points. First of all, that study has been duplicated so many times with different things. Free throws from a free throw line in basketball, same thing. Just as many, as much improvement with those sitting on the side, just looking up and imagining it, as those who actually physically practiced. We can look at the placebo effect. We know that 60% of all medical interventions that don't count mechanical replacements like knee replacements have a placebo effect. Even a torn meniscus, you cut somebody's knee open and sew it back up, and they have the same benefits in 60% of the cases as those who actually trimmed the meniscus. So this is natural, but we have made it unnatural and given it power to others, because it's not just visualization. That's one of the things that, you know, before we finish this part of it, we'll talk about the difference between just imagining something. Like right now, if I said, Derek, imagine that there's an orange in front of you and you're peeling it. Your mind might be doing that, but it wouldn't be seeding itself in terms of changing brain synapses, because you're likely still in the same brain frequency waves. You actually have to change slightly. It's not a significant thing. And there's very simple ways to do that, we can get to, using ideomotor movements that will let you know that you have made that switch before you visualize, right? So, and there's things with how you use words. You know, golfers, if they see a sand trap, and they learn a little bit of hypnosis, but not enough, might say, I'm not going to hit the ball in the sand trap. And of course, the most image producing word is sand trap, and that's where they'll hit it. So they learn to visualize hitting it into the fairway, etc. But it's not rocket science. It's not something that you have to be afraid of. It's not something that only a medical professional can use, because we use it all the time. And unfortunately, we use it negatively with children too often. you know, a big tall teacher coming up and saying, you're never going to amount to anything, George, because your mathematics skills are so bad. That could last a lifetime.
Well, that actually brings up something else that is going to keep us on this topic, which is something I've thought about since I was, literally since I was a child, is I've noticed that somebody can say in either a good thing or a bad thing to you at a certain moment, and it doesn't seem to have a large effect on you. And somebody can say that same thing to you when you in a different space, and it can be devastating or really helpful. And the language I came up with that for that when I was maybe 10 or something is I called it windows of sensitivity. That it seems like there are moments when you are especially open, and if somebody said to you in that moment, Johnny, you're never going to accomplish anything, then that can just devastate you. And then other times we're less. And so I think part of what we're getting at is that process of not opening up to the terrible things like that, but just opening oneself up to, I mean, those seem to be induced different states that are present. Do you see what I'm trying to get at?
I love your phrase. I've never heard that, you know, before phrased that way. But you know, this window of sensitivity is exactly what I'm talking about. And under our indigenous worldview, and those who still are able to abide by it, they realize that there are ways to bring about those windows of sensitivity. I love that. And do so in this naturalistic way in order to bring about the kinds of goals that we have. Instead, our windows in our dominant culture, for the most part, these windows of sensitivity are forced open by others sometimes, or they happen to be open, like you say, just at the time when somebody says something that will last for a lifetime. This is why, again, fear, authority, words, and nature are inseparable from what we're talking about. Because in the dominant culture, you know, words are not as sacred. They don't. The effort to make sure they speak truth is not there. And with that, coupled with the spontaneous, I'm going to use your phrase, windows of sensitivity, that's where we wind up doing things that somebody from an outer spaceship looking down at us would go, well, they're either completely crazy or they're in hypnosis.
Well, okay, so I want to ask one more thing about this trans-based learning. I promise this will be the last thing before we go to fear, authority, words, and nature. And that is that I read Lewis Mumford in my 30s and just found him tremendously fabulous on so many levels. And one thing that he talked about was he really hated rock concerts. And he talked about how they were sort of toxic mimics. He didn't use that language, but toxic mimics of these trance states. And at the time, I still liked rock concerts. And so I was I disagree with him on that. But maybe a year or two ago, I just, for the heck of it, looked up there was this huge AC/DC concert in South America somewhere, and the entire audience was pulsing as they're playing their songs. And I suddenly got it. And so before we go to the fear, or maybe as the transition to fear, authority, words, and nature, you know, I felt the same thing watching a little bit of both the Republican and Democratic conventions, where you have this mass of people all chanting USA or all chanting, and it frankly terrified me. And it was the same with the feeling with the looking at the AC/DC concert now as a person in my 50s. And so can we talk for a moment? You've brought this up several times about the sort of the opposite of trans-based learning, where people end up in these hypnotized states. Do you see what I'm trying to get at with this question?
Well, absolutely. In fact, I write about that when I've written originally about the Cat Fawn connection. Under words, I had a whole chapter on music. You know, and I wrote about the secret power of music. I wrote about how music has the power to heal and to alter states of consciousness and to hypnotize and incite passion this is why music is in indigenous cultures such an intrinsic part of daily living. I used to do a fun exercise. You know, I play old-time piano. And if anybody wants to hear it, just put in Four Arrows Piano in YouTube. You can hear my old songs at the University of Mississippi last month. But I used to do a little thing where I would go up on the stage when I was speaking about worldview stuff, and I'd say, who out there cannot play the piano? And of course, you know, most of the audience raises their hand, and I would look at somebody and I would say, what is your name? And she'd say, Judy. And I'd bring her up to the stage and I'd wheel a piano out and I'd whisper in her ear, I just want you to play the black notes, but I want you to do it with confidence. And then I would tell the audience, you know, Judy and I used to play blues in New Orleans a long, long time ago. I know a lot of people don't know that, but we're going to do what we used to do. Anyway, make a long story short, I would tell her, don't start playing until I bump your shoulder with my shoulder. And I would start playing sort of a blues boogie rhythm, and I'd watch her eyes closed until I saw her sway just a little bit. Then I'd bump her and she would just hit those black notes. Well, because, you know, we were in the same key essentially, there wouldn't be any discordance. She would play and play and play. And then we were done. I would make the point that everybody has this ability, whereas in dominant culture, you know, people, if you're not as good as Barbara Streisand or Van Cliburn, you don't touch it. And, you know, I've had husbands in the hallway yelling at their wives, you never told me you played in New Orleans with that guy, you know, that kind of stuff. So, music is a part of language. And, so I'm so happy you brought it up.
So you talk about the importance of the different approaches to fear, authority, words, and nature between these different worldviews. So, I've blown our plan already that we were going to do 8 minutes each, and we have about 20 minutes left for these four. So can we do like a few minutes on the different relationships? Let's start with fear. The different relationships between the two different worldviews having to do with fear and how that relates to trance-based learning.
Well, on one condition, Derek, that you don't hesitate if there's another addition, because then we just will have to do this again.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Okay. All right. So, okay, look, fear in dominant culture, I'm going to be real brief, is to be avoided at all costs. In our culture, and I could cite philosophers all the way back to Socrates, this idea of fear ultimately is something that we don't want, and we avoid it. So we're sort of, who was it? Churchill has said the only thing to fear is fear itself, or something like that. But so we have philosophers that know better here and there, but essentially, we do not see fear. And I'm talking about once the immediate fight or flight response is handled, we no longer see them fear as an opportunity to practice a virtue. In traditional indigenous cultures, and I've lived with a number of them and I've studied, I found that as you grow up, courage is considered to be sort of the mother of all of the other virtues. And interesting, the highest expression of courage is generosity. Even in recent years, when I lived on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, I remember seeing, a child with a little puppy that was just everything to that child visit a cousin who had just lost their father. And without any compulsion from the parents or orders from the parents to do this, I've seen this little girl give away her most cherished possession. And that takes a lot of courage. And so this idea that generosity is the highest expression of courage is just one of the ways. So if you're coming upon a trail, let's say you're out getting some blueberries here. I'm in the Pacific Northwest right now, right up against the rainforest on the west coast of Vancouver Island. We got lots of black bear and wolves here. So let's say I'm going out to get some catberries, and I come upon a big mother black bear, and her baby is up in a tree, so I know she's going to be unusually dangerous. Well, my fight or flight response takes in. I know I can't outrun, and I know I can't fight. So there I am. Well, instead of panic and all these kinds of other things that would happen typically if you're under a worldview that doesn't understand what I'm about to say, I might kind of go, well, let's see. What virtue am I practicing and need to work on? Is it humility? Is it honesty? Is it generosity? Is it courage? Is it patience? Whatever, right? And I would choose one of those. I mean, I'm using this in a very concentrated way to make the point. But let's say I chose to practice generosity. So I would genuinely take my berries and set them down and say, Mother Bear, if you need these berries, you know, more than I, please have them. And in fact, if you need my flesh, if it's, you know, more than I need these berries, then I give myself to you. Well, the bear is going to let you go. So this idea of using fear as a way to practice one of the virtues, and I could give examples for, you know, for all of honesty, humility, all of these things that I mentioned, I could give examples for that are real life ones. Well, that is actually what happens. And as a result, the courage that has been encouraged and practiced actually leads to what Gandhi is the only philosopher that I have found that agrees with this, because from Socrates on, everyone says fearlessness is foolishness. But once you have practiced a virtue via courage, and then you commit to an action, once you commit to that action, under this worldview, you begin to trust the universe, and that brings you into fearlessness. Now, when you think about this, I have an athlete that's in the Olympics now. She brought me out of retirement because I used to be a sports psychologist, Natalie Molhausen, and she's a fencer. And she went from 265 in the world, now she's fifth in the world. She beat the French lady in the morning and then lost to her in the afternoon. I think she got overconfident. But we used this concept of courage from the very beginning. I could tell you stories about how we did, some crazy ones. That are kind of funny. I'd love to share with you. Like one time on a six-story building in Cuba, I walked out the window of my room and slid across a six-inch ledge and knocked on her window in the next room in preparation for a session, inviting her out because I knew that would scare the hell out of her, just to put her in a state of responsiveness that I could really do the hypnosis successfully. So anyway, this concept that we're talking about brings you into fearlessness, and it's good because if you have to use the energy of courage every time you're in a difficult situation, that wears you down. Even if you're successful and you're courageous, when it's over with, it's like, whew, wow, holy cow, I don't want to do that again. But if courage brings you into this place where you trust the universe, and this is taught in indigenous storytelling, another form of hypnosis. Then you move into fearlessness, and that fearlessness doesn't have all of that adrenaline and all of those stress potentials. So this is powerful stuff. And of course, because fear makes you this is an important sentence I'm going to say. Because fear makes us all, I'm talking wild horses included, hyper-suggestible, hyper-sensitive, using your Windows idea, to the communication or signals of a perceived trusted authority figure. So this is why a paramedic on the scene can come up to somebody who's hurt very badly and assume they're in spontaneous hypnosis and know they're in a culture where external authority is very important to them. They could come up to that person and say, listen, my name is Dr. So-and-so or paramedic so-and-so. The worst is over. Things are being made ready at the hospital, but you're hemorrhaging really bad and I can't get inside that car to reach you right now. So when I count to three, I want you to stop your bleeding. Well, this happens. This can happen if you speak with confidence, et cetera, et cetera, and some of the little things that I can teach. But this is how powerful this is. And we've got to realize that fear sets the stage for us being hypnotized by authority figures. This is why Goebbels and the propaganda administrator for Hitler said, I can get people in any country under any form of government to do what I say. I just got to make them afraid. And so this is happening today. We're seeing it in the political realm for the presidency. And once we can understand this, that fear can be a wonderful tool for practicing generosity and patience and virtues and bringing us in beyond courage into fearlessness, and then at the same time making us aware of when our stress level puts us into this window of sensitivity, which is something a friend of mine coined when he was a young man, that window of sensitivity is operating. Therefore, when you hear some of the hypnotic strategies like a Rush Limbaugh double bind, you're either with us or against us, you know, that kind of thing. Same thing in medical emergencies. Would you be more comfortable with your arm here or here? And talking to a person who's not comfortable, they'll become comfortable, and then you use that. It gives us a degree of power. Once we are using authority so that we realize that it's not external authority, but only lived reflection on lived experience, once we realize that words, especially our self-talk, are sacred and powerful energies that can hypnotize us, and on, then we can then get to the root of what is happening in our world to cause such violence and such ignorant imbalance.
Well, let's move on. Thank you for that. And that's great. That's fabulous stuff. And there's 15 questions I want to ask, but let's move on to the different relationships to authority. You've sort of brought that up right then.
Yeah. And that's I didn't know how much time we had, and I wanted to sneak it in because again, these things are all inseparable. So in indigenous cultures, hierarchy is not at all what it is in our dominant culture. Now, people, you know, I've had scholars challenging me on this over the years, and they'll go, well, what about, you know, in the Pacific Islands, in Hawaii, you know, they always had kings and queens and hierarchy. Well, the research really shows that even when in the 75% of all pre-contact indigenous cultures were completely non-hierarchical, most were matriarchal, but where they did have hierarchy, and there was a number of them, what we saw is called reverse dominance. And I won't go into it, but in reverse dominance, really, the person in charge was really not in charge. You know, what they did was more a figurehead. And if I'll give you an example. I lived with the Tarahumara Rarámuri of Mexico. And down in the canyon, 8,000 feet down, the Rarámuri have not been influenced by Christianity and other Western influences. And they have a man called the Sukurume, who is a shaman who has natural talents that are quite remarkable. Being able to change the weather, for example. I've seen it happen. Just like the Seri Indian shamans can call the turtles into an island. So here we have a situation where this Tarahumara shaman, maybe they, you know, they, their power goes to their head, which it can for anybody under any worldview if you don't practice all these things just right. And so this greedy shaman starts doing things that are wrong. Well, in this culture, they just fire his ass, right? He's gone. He's out of there, and that's all there is to it. He has to go pack up and leave. Now move 8,000 feet up the canyon, same exact people, same language, and same Sukarume, same shaman. But these folks are all practicing Christians. You know, they've been forced into it through the missionary schools and through all the other reasons. Now they have a Sukarume who's also powerful, but it becomes greedy. Guess what happens? He becomes a sorcerer. Somebody to be feared, and then takes over in a negative way much of the power, as you might see in voodoo work in Jamaica. Now, you know, I can only speculate that that worldview, this idea of the polarities, the devil, all this kind of stuff, has influenced this difference. But I no one studied it really. I've written about it, but I've not really studied it. So fear is this double-edged sword. It can give us the power to really transform ourselves if we understand its connection to trance-based learning, or if we don't understand it, it puts us into continual jeopardy for wrong action.
You've said that. Well, I want to say one thing about authority, which is that it seems to me that the entire dominant culture, we could look at the entire dominant culture as suffering from what Judith Herman would call complex post-traumatic stress disorder, where people have been held in captivity, they've been battered, they've been assaulted. Over time, they can come to believe that all relationships are hierarchical. And they can come to believe that, I mean, if you're in prison, the guards don't have your best interests at heart. And they can come to believe that all relationships of hierarchy of any sort, using the term hierarchy as value neutral as possible, they can come to believe that all of those are exploitative. But if you have a relationship between a mother bear and the baby bears, it's hierarchical in that the mother bear is in charge, but she has the best interests of the babies at heart. And so for me, if you step outside of this traumatized worldview, it is possible to have someone who actually does have some authority over you, who actually does have your best interests at heart. Is that also what we're getting at?
Well, but you're slipping a little bit into the Western worldview as you say that. Here's why. The mother bear, and I can say the same thing for mother traditional Lakotas and father traditional Lakotas, the mother bear will protect the young one as best she can with warnings, with role modeling, etc. But rarely will actually take charge, except in maybe very extreme situations. In the same way that I can remember a Lakota man with his little 7-year-old child wanting to mount a horse and ride it with no saddle and no bridle. And I was with some Europeans who were visiting the reservation, and they just immediately thought when the little boy said, "Daddy, can I get up on him and ride him?" They thought for sure that Daddy would say no, because they had seen the horse and saw that it was a little skittish, and they kind of just, you know, were blown away when he said something to the effect, "Are you sure that you'll be able to stay on and not get hurt and fall off, etc.?" You know, and all in Lakota. And the little boy looked with confidence and said, "Yeah." The dad put him on. Now, the dad is an authority figure, could have said, "No, you're not ready." But there's this sense of authority comes from learned experience and from reflecting on learned experience. And this child had grown up in a traditional culture where that was the priority. And it wasn't a hierarchy necessarily. It was, you know, you look at the council of your elders and the spiritual guides and your parents, but they're not seen as authority figures. That's why traditional indigenous cultures are so permissive. So there's a slight difference there. I just wanted to see if I could subtle that difference out.
Great. So, we've talked, do you want to talk more? We've got like 4 minutes left. We've done it again. So there's also words and nature. Can you bring those together with the relationship, the different relationships with words? Sorry to give these such short shrift. Different relationship between words, between the culture, the worldviews, and the different relationship with nature and related to trance-based learning.
Yeah, and you know, it's like all the profits for this book are going to, First Peoples worldwide. So, we're not gonna, I hope people will want to go by Point of Departure and learn these things a little bit more in detail. But, you know, words, whether we say them to ourselves or to others, are really, the source of hypnotic, imagery. And, you know, this is one reason why indigenous languages are verb-based. it's very difficult to categorize and label with indigenous languages because they're sort of always in motion. But in the English language, we can still work it, and we just have to be very, very careful with the words that we use and understand that they do have a vibrational frequency that can both induce hypnotic states inadvertently or can guide us when we are in these altered states of consciousness and beta or theta, where we then become susceptible to believing in them for good or for bad. So that's the words. In nature, you know, that's kind of maybe for some people, you know, at least from the movies and all of this, you know, one of the few things that we've sometimes overly romanticized about indigenous people who did affect their environments also. But they truly saw us as a part of nature. And in fact, most cultures see other than humans as teachers. Because they were here first, because of their innateness, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I've done an experiment, I'll close with this, I think, Derek. I've done this experiment all over the place, in Japan, Australia, with kids, with adults, where I'll have people, and we might even have talked about this before, I'll have people go outside and touch a plant, touch a tree and come back. And they'll get up from, you know, having just sat down for my presentation, and they'll get up, they'll walk and touch something and come back. And, you know, look a little bit puzzled, like, what was that about? And then I'll say, now you're probably going to laugh. I'm going to ask you to do it again. But this time, I want you to ask permission of the plant before you touch it. And now you're really going to laugh. I want you to wait for an answer. And of course, most people and kids, whether it's kids or they're, Japanese people in a Buddhist monastery, they have reactions to it, but they go out willingly, and just because they came to, you know, to hear me. And so they go out, and Derek, when they come back in the room, especially the children, it's just unbelievable. The communication that happens. I had one child in Mexico after the hurricane down there tell me that, you know, that this tree had talked about having lost these other trees that were around it and gone through this. And I mean, it just brings tears to your eyes, right? And so this understanding of nature as not just being something that humans use, you know, like one of my co-authors I invited to write a book, Differing Worldviews, Two Scholars Argued Cooperatively, is a free market guy, Walter Block, professor. And he believed, you know, we came to some common ground, which was my goal, but he truly believes, as most people that support the capitalist society, that only humans have intrinsic value. And to believe otherwise, you can't have economic externalities. You know, you have to believe that. And even those of us who are, you know, not following the religious thing that we are stewards of the world and all of these things, and that we are liberal and we love animals, at some level, it's more likely that we believe that, well, like Walter's excuses, he said, well, if you had a choice between killing a human or an ant, which would you do? I mean, he uses those kind of ridiculous, kind of Rush Limbaughisms, I call them. But ultimately, when you have the respect for all of life and you use words accordingly, and you realize that the ultimate authority is honest reflection on experience, and that one mode of learning has to do with trance-based learning, that's a real good start for us to recapture what we had before our point of departure.
Well, that's beautiful. Thank you so much. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been 4 Arrows. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.